This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. Clarence M. Mitchell, Jr., born in Baltimore in 1911, became one of the leading civil rights activists of the 20th century. He served as chief lobbyist for the NAACP when Congress passed landmark legislation on civil rights, voting rights, and fair housing. Mitchell spent so much time in the halls of Congress, he became known as the 101st Senator. Three decades earlier, Clarence Mitchell was a newspaper reporter for the Baltimore Afro-American, and it was his experience as a journalist on Maryland's Eastern Shore that sent him into civil rights advocacy. Mitchell reported on the lynching of a black man named George Armwood. In this podcast, we will hear Clarence Mitchell describe his experiences in the town where Armwood was tortured and murdered by a mob 85 years ago. We're able to do that because Clarence Mitchell sat for a recording for the Maryland Historical Society in 1977. In the fall of 1933, George Armwood, a laborer who some people considered mentally impaired, had been arrested for the attempted rape of an elderly white woman. This was in Somerset County on the Lower Eastern Shore. He was seized and beaten by an armed mob, then jailed in Salisbury in Wicomico County, where just 2 years earlier, a black man named Matthew Williams had been lynched. So there was no way to guarantee Armwood's safety. State police took him to Baltimore. But as you'll hear from Clarence Mitchell, officials from Somerset County persuaded the Maryland governor, Albert Ritchie, to return Armwood to the local jail. So he was taken to Princess Anne, the seat of Somerset County, where soon a mob formed, alerted to Armwood's presence in the jail by radio reports. Police could not stop them or their battering rams. They broke into the jail and grabbed Armwood. As Clarence Mitchell would later report for the Afro-American, before he was hung from a tree some distance away, Armwood was dragged through the streets, beaten, stabbed, and had one ear hacked off. Armwood's lifeless body was then paraded through the town, finally ended up near the town's courthouse, where the mob doused the corpse with gasoline and set it on fire. Clarence Mitchell entered this hostile territory the next day, arriving while Armwood's body was there for all to see. He was a black man reporting news of the lynching of a black man for a black-owned newspaper. In this recording, which has been digitally enhanced to improve listening quality, you will hear from time to time the voice of the interviewer, Charles Wagant. Mitchell references Maryland Governor Ritchie. He reminds us that the Chesapeake Bay Bridge had not yet been built in those days, requiring use of train, ferry, and car to get to the shore from Baltimore. And he uses the term feeble-minded with regard to Armwood's mental capacity. The Afro-American asserted in an editorial in 1933 that a number of cognitively disabled black adults were used as cheap labor in, quote, peonage, ignorance, and serfdom on the Eastern Shore in what was merely a polite term for slavery. Now to the recording. At the outset, Clarence Mitchell states that he arrived to do his reporting right after Armwood's murder.
We got there right after it happened. The crowd was still there. It had been well publicized. It operated on a schedule which was announced on the radio.
When the thing was going to take place, and the authorities didn't take adequate steps to prevent it?
They might have gone through the motions, but they didn't take adequate steps. You see, in a situation such as that, the victim had been brought to Baltimore while he was still alive, of course, for safekeeping. He was supposed to have molested an elderly white woman on one of those farms or in some part of the area surrounding Princess Anne. Also, the story has it that he was feeble-minded, but be that as it may, whatever happened, it aroused such antagonism that he was brought to Baltimore City for safekeeping. And Governor Albert C. Ritchie was governor at that time. He was urged to send this man back on the ground that it was a reflection on the people in Princess Anne to say that anything would happen and that he should be sent back. Well, it turned out that because 2 years before in Salisbury there had been a lynching, anybody with his common sense should have known that it was hazardous to send this person back. But the Eastern Shore then was an important political entity, and I assume the government didn't want to antagonize them any more than they already had, or any more than they had been antagonized, but we would work the victim away. So there were these announcements that came over the radio. In those days, radio was much more primitive than it is now, but it was sufficient for you to know what was happening. And the team that was supposed to go down there from the Afro-American was supposed to start when the word came out that the crowd had gathered and the lynching was about to take place. They knew that something would happen, and the something that everybody expected was a lynching.
Yeah.
And that is the reason why we went. The Baltimore Sun had its newspaper reporters down there. And we had to go a long way around, you know, at that time, up over through Havre de Grace, I guess.
Yeah.
But anyway, whatever way it was, we had to go around, and all the way, of course, we were picking up these reports of what was happening. Somebody gave me a pistol. I had never fired a pistol in my life, so I stuck it down in the upholstery of the seat. I don't know what happened to it, whether anybody ever found it or not, but anyway. When we got down there, the crowd was there. They had actually completed the lynching at the time. They hanged and then poured gasoline on the body and set it on fire. And it was right out there in the middle of the street. It was a horrible sight with all these people standing around. My recollection is that the fire was out, but the body was still in a state of singe, you know. And the interesting thing, too, was at that time, crowd must have been more or less surfeited because they were standing around, but being young and brash, I went around asking people questions.
How'd you feel, though, when you saw this?
Well, it was a revolting sight. There's no doubt about that. I see a fellow human lying there in the middle of the street in that kind of a condition. See, by that time, he'd been cut down by somebody. I suppose all might have just burned down because the body was saturated with gasoline, and maybe that the gasoline just burned the roof. I doubt whether anybody was taking the trouble to give him any respectful attention. And we went around asking people.
You weren't scared?
Well, now at that time, as I said, when you're young, you have a lot of foolish notions. Somehow, they seem to me in the status of a reporter. People would not bother you, that you had a kind of immunity to violence, which
I... Was it obvious that you were a reporter?
Well, I had my press card in my hat, and other reporters were milling around. But at the time, that was the worst thing I could have done, because the crowd was very much annoyed with the whole press. I didn't realize it, of course. And
What kind of response did you get from these people?
Well, generally, nobody knew anything. They said that... Well, a lot of people came over here from Virginia, and the people who did this, we don't know anything about it. I remember we had one photographer with us, Paul Henderson, and there was a man who came up and looked at this body, a white man, and I was asking him a question too. Paul Henderson tried to get his picture, and this man was smart enough to move out of the way, you know, so he would never be in focus. Paul, I don't know whether he had anything to do with it or not. He might have been just there in sympathy. But Paul said he probably was one of those who was involved in it. Well, when we came back, I must say that it was the kind of experience you don't forget, and to indicate the seriousness of what the situation was. About a month or so later, there was a disturbance in that same community, and a great many of the blacks were chased out of the town. A large number of reporters, these were white reporters, were chased into a hotel. The hotel was set on fire.
Really?
Yes, the Sun reported. But I had this interesting little experience. I went down to cover it, of course, and at that time I was alone. Or maybe somebody dropped me. I don't remember how I got there, but it was only one train a day out of there. So I stayed at the home of Dr. C.L. Kaya, K-I-A-H, who was at that time the head of the Princess Anne Academy. So I stayed there overnight, and the next morning we were out on the street. The sheriff, who knew Dr. Carr, came up, and Dr. Carr introduced me to the sheriff. But he didn't say I was a reporter. So the sheriff said, yes, if we could just stop these damn reporters from coming in here, giving our town a bad name. Needless to say, I was indicated that I was connected with the press. But then Dr. Carr left me, and I was on my own, and I went to the place where some of these people who had caused the disturbance were supposed to be on trial. I had only been used to the courtroom situation as you find in Baltimore, you know, where you have a regular courtroom with seats and that kind of thing. But this place where the people were brought in, these were whites who were charged with creating the disturbance, this place was jammed. Everybody was standing up. It was seemingly a little office. And you had to push your way in to get in. So I must say that it didn't seem to be the safest place in the world to be, so I was hesitant about going in. When there was a little argument among blacks who were standing on the outside. One fellow who had a few drinks, I think, said, if I could just get one person to go in there with me, I'd go in. They called him Monk. So I said, well, I'm going in there. Will you go with me? And all his friends, of course, called his bluff that he couldn't back out. But he got in there, and the first thing he did was stepped on a white man's foot. Well, you can imagine what happened. This white man looked at him and said, nigger, I'll kill you. You stepped on my foot. And he didn't say anything to me. He sort of looked me over, but he said this directly to Monk. And while Monk was making his excuses, another white man stepped up and said, Monk, I've got a package over at the station. Why don't you go over there and pick it up for me? Well, that got Monk out of the line of fire and left me in there in that uncomfortable position. I couldn't figure out what was happening. It seemed to me that they were giving these fellows a lecture. I don't think anything much was done to them. So we all left. And then I went over to the station to catch this one train a day out. I must say that was the longest wait. I was mighty glad that it came, but I went up to Delaware to get back.
That was Clarence M. Mitchell, Jr., recounting for the Maryland Historical Society in 1977 his experiences in Princess Anne on the Eastern Shore and covering the lynching of 22-year-old George Armwood in October 1933. According to the Archives of Maryland, a grand jury heard testimony from 42 witnesses to the Armwood lynching. They claimed that the organizers of the lynching were not local people. But it was apparent that people of Salisbury and Princess Anne were deeply involved in the lynching. State police identified 9 men as leaders of the mob. And yet, a local jury issued no indictment for Armwood's murder, a fact that thousands of whites cheered. George Armwood was the last victim of a lynching in Maryland. For more on this subject, read Sun reporter Jonathan Pitts's deep look at the history of lynchings in Maryland, and there are links to other articles in the notes with this podcast. You can find all of that at BaltimoreSun.com. There is also Sherrilyn Ifill's book, On the Courthouse Lawn, Confronting the Legacy of Lynching in the 21st Century, published in 2007 by the Beacon Press. This is Dan Rodericks.